This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton. Thanks for joining us on our radio Main Street across North Dakota this time of day. And today we're going to have something really special and somewhat different on our show. We're going to talk to a teenager, a senior at Davies High School, who's already shown remarkable promise as a musician. And she joins us in our studio. Joanna Lynn is a senior at Davies High School. She plays clarinet and piano, and she is already quite an accomplished musician. Thanks for being with us, Joanna.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Let's get a little background here. When did you start playing clarinet?
So I started clarinet in sixth grade at Discovery Middle School. I decided to join band for the fun of it, just to try it out.
And you play piano too?
Yes, I've been playing piano since I was around 6 years old, I think.
So what do you think drove you to music? Is this something that's been part of your life? I mean, even before sixth grade?
Yes, absolutely. So my parents would always listen to classical music in the car. They would have like Little Einsteins and those sorts of CDs. So I was always exposed to that. And so piano was kind of with my parents' encouragement too. And I was like, okay, you know, I want to try it out for fun. And so I always enjoyed it a lot. But I think with clarinet, kind of that competitiveness and being able to join more ensembles and play with other people versus just solo at the piano really pushed me to work a lot harder at my music and to look for more opportunities to kind of expand that music.
Well, let's give our listeners a sample of what you can do with a clarinet. Introduce this first piece.
Yeah, so this is the Poulenc Sonata for clarinet and piano, and this one is the third movement.
That's a wow. So how long did it take you to learn how to do that besides all of your life up to now?
Yeah. I would say for that piece, it was probably because I worked on the entire sonata, which is about 13 minutes. And so it was probably like 4 months in advance, I would say, which is quite a long time. But I also, it was during school, so I wasn't able to practice as much as I would like. So
this is obviously something that isn't just work to you. You like doing this,
yes,
I take it,
of course.
Because otherwise you wouldn't spend 4 months on it.
Yeah, yes.
And where did you perform that?
So for this one, I performed it at the MTNA competition.
What's that?
So it goes at the regional, state, and national level. And I performed in the woodwind division, but there's also competitions for piano, for, I think, strings. I'm not exactly sure about the other categories. But so I use that for the MTNA competitions. And I also use that for my National Youth Orchestra 2 edition.
Well, and that you were selected. So tell us about the National Youth Orchestra 2.
Yeah, it's an incredible program. I actually auditioned my freshman year 3 years ago, and I did not make it in, which I'm completely at peace with because I would not have been ready.
But these are some very good young musicians, aren't they?
Yeah, the best. And so it's a three-week program put on by Carnegie Hall's WOW Music Institute, which is kind of their outreach and education department. And what happens is it was 3 weeks. We started out in New York State at Purchase College with about a week and a half of residency. We worked with guest conductor. We just kind of toured the campus, got to know each other. And then after that, we spent a week in Miami where we performed with our guest soloist, the pianist Gabriela Montero, and our final conductor. And then we performed in the New World Symphony Hall, a beautiful concert hall designed by Frank Gehry.
Wow.
And then, yes, incredible. And then finally, we went back to New York City for 2 days and then performed in Carnegie Hall.
So you got to travel around, got to play with some other really talented young musicians and see a bit of the country.
Absolutely.
So you were one of three clarinets to be selected.
Yes.
How big is this orchestra and how big an honor is this?
I would say it is quite a big honor. And what's special about NYO2 versus kind of the larger, the parents organization, which is National Youth Orchestra of the United States. NYO2 has more of a focus of attracting students from more underrepresented communities.
And like so, not New York.
Yeah, exactly. Instead of New York, California, Texas, it's a little bit more geographically diverse, which I think did play in my favor a little bit. And yeah.
Well, you also play as the principal clarinet of the North Dakota All-State Orchestra. Mm-hmm. You are with the Fargo-Moorhead Area Youth Symphony and the Davies Wind Ensemble. So you keep quite busy. You belong to lots of groups. And again, you must obviously like doing it. You were the winner of the 2018 Thorsen Steffes Young Artist Solo Competition. Tell us about that.
Yeah, so that was last year. Oh, no. Wait. Yeah, 2 years ago.
You've lost track of
it all. And it was an incredible opportunity to be able, after the competition, having won, I was able to be a guest artist with the Fargo-Moorhead Symphony Orchestra and perform the Spohr Clarinet Concerto with them, which was incredible. I grew so much from the experience, and it was really fun.
Yeah. So you worked with the conductor, right?
The
principal conductor of the FM Symphony Orchestra.
Mm-hmm.
And how would you describe the music culture of where you live, Fargo-Moorhead?
I would say Fargo-Moorhead is definitely an island. And it's just incredible how there's, you know, if you take time to think about it, we have three music universities. There's quite a few regional honor bands. And, you know, with like my school, Davies, the band program is the largest actual extracurricular of our entire school.
Wow.
And it's just the music culture here, I think it's very strong. And in general, the arts and a lot of with organizations like the Arts Partnership and what they're doing to advocate more for the arts, it's incredibly strong.
Well, I know we've got the symphony orchestra. There's the opera. Mm-hmm. There's jazz pretty much all over around here, too. Lots of club artists who are playing big bands. So there's quite a rich culture here. Is there any kind of music that you much prefer? Is it, for example, classical music? Is that your area? Or do you like other stuff, too?
I mean, I love listening to all sorts of music. I think classical is what I feel closest to just because I have the experience of being not just a listener but a performer as well. And I think that adds a lot more depth to my listening experience. But lately I've been getting into all sorts of music too.
Have you ever thought of composing?
No, actually. I don't know if composing would be my strong area. Composing it takes so much knowledge of music theory, and it's definitely a commitment to be able to stick to that.
Well, a clarinet can be a pretty fun component in a jazz band. Have you ever thought about doing that? Do a little improvisation?
I have thought about it a little bit, but for now, I thought I would stick to my classical path for now.
Tell us about the North Dakota All-State Orchestra, where you play principal clarinet.
Yeah, so in North Dakota, there's an all-state ensemble for the choir, the band, and the orchestra. And with the orchestra, it's a full orchestra, which means that they have wind players and brass players, percussion. And it's just an amazing experience. It happens once a year. And it's just really fun to be able to play with students from across the state and see some people who I've met at Allstate before, but we only see each other once a year. And it's just cool to reconnect every year over music.
And you don't just do music. You also participated with the Young Entrepreneurs Academy in Fargo-Moorhead. What's that?
Yeah, it's it's a relatively new program. I was the second year of graduates, and it's put on by the Chamber of Commerce, and it happens during the school year, and we would meet once a week to start our own business, basically. And what happened was at the end there was a Shark Tank pitch, and so in front of an investor panel,
like that TV show, huh?
Yes, exactly. And so we pitched in front of them. We got funding for our business. Not everybody continued their business, including me, but it was an incredible experience to learn from local community business people and to be able to go through the process of writing a business plan and really listen to, I think we even had like a lawyer come talk about, you know, copyright issues and things like that, that you might kind of more of the nitty gritty. It was cool to get into that.
So what business did you invent?
So that one I started, it's called EcoPots, and it was more of an environmentally focused business. And so I would repurpose milk cartons from schools and turn them into eco-friendly planter kits. And it was, I learned so much from it. I actually had it sold in Baker Garden and Gift for a while. But then I realized the market wasn't quite as strong as I had hoped. And the product was more, I wasn't passionate enough about the product itself.
You weren't going to spend 4 months like training for a particular clarinet piece of classical music. Okay. Mm-hmm. You are the founder and the executive director of a nonprofit called Resonate. Mm-hmm. What is that?
Yeah, so Resonate is kind of like the brainchild of what started after EcoPots. And I started it, let's see, it was 501c3 certified October of last year. And so it's pretty new as well. And what Resonate does is Resonate focuses on inspiring and providing exposure to students and musicians in rural areas. And when I was thinking of this idea, I, you know, looked online, I looked for different organizations with a focus on rural areas, and I found absolutely nothing. And maybe that's just how I Google, but I couldn't find anything. And I was really shocked by that because I think North Dakota is often defined by, you know, the little towns, smaller communities, under 2,000 people. And there was nothing out there to help these musicians see more of what it's like to be in a professional, you know, a professional musician. And what Resonate does is I organize unique masterclasses, musical masterclasses, and college students will travel to a school, so a group of about 4 to 5 as a chamber ensemble. And then they'll travel to the school, perform, and then go back to the music and explain how they interpreted the music and what musical decisions they made, you know, some difficult spots and how they worked through it. And then finally, they'll, you know, give an overview of the college, of what how to continue music and some advice on that. And so it's meant to be elevate the performance beyond just a typical passive listening experience and really show the students like a glimpse into how a professional musician thinks and how they approach music and how it's really so much more than the notes. And when you listen to the final performance, there's so many decisions that go into it that you couldn't even be aware of. In that, as you know, musicians themselves, to be able to be more exposed to that and to see that kind of real time, I think is very beneficial.
So you're a senior in high school, or you're going to be, and you're working with college students and getting them to a smaller community and share their musical skills and knowledge, and also to essentially sell their program too, right?
Yeah.
It works for everybody.
Yes, exactly.
Okay. Yeah. So what's a typical response to this?
Yeah, so far I organized 2 masterclasses this year. It took a while to get things started, contact the colleges, and by the time I had the masterclasses in May, the school year was over, so I had to take a little break. But I had a survey sent out, and the results were pretty successful. And I remember one was that 1 in 2 students learned something that they had never learned before, and that 3 in 4 felt 90% felt more inspired to look for more music opportunities just from this one masterclass, which I think is incredible. And it really shows the potential of what Resonate can do and also how much more there is to do.
And so you've actually been doing this. And did you talk about this at 1 Million Cups this summer?
Yeah, 1 Million Cups I gave. It was part of a special Young Entrepreneurs Academy showcase. There was another past graduate who spoke. And yeah, I spoke about Resonate, where we're going, our plans, and just to show the community a little bit of what Resonate has been doing.
Well, if Joanna Lynn was looking ahead, say, 10 years in her life, and that would be half of your life again, where do you see yourself? What's your career aspiration? Are you in business? Are you in music? What are you doing?
I'm not sure, because I think I'm not going into music professionally, but my experience with Resonate and with EcoPods has really, like, I've developed definitely an interest in business and management and kind of nonprofit management. And so I'm also very interested in languages. So I think maybe some sort of international business is in the works, maybe, or a linguistics minor. It's still a little bit up in the air.
So, well, you've got these college visits coming up pretty soon, mm-hmm. if not now, to select something, a place you want to go. Mm-hmm. How's that proceeding?
It's confusing.
There's a lot of opportunity out there for somebody like you.
Yeah, it's overwhelming. There's so many options, and I think I'm trying to kind of explore some different options, and I don't know. We'll kind of see where it goes.
Well, let's listen to another piece of you playing clarinet. Introduce this piece for our listeners.
So this one is the Weber Clarinet Concerto No. 1 and the first movement.
When you play, Joanna, of course there are notes there, and you were talking about this when you take Raisonnette to a small town, that there's a, you know, there's a piece of music in front of you, but there's something else too. Mm-hmm. There's a way you interpret music, the way you feel when you play it, and the way you want the audience to feel.
Absolutely. And I think being at NYO2 this summer taught me so many more ways that I could really express the character of the piece to an audience. And as a performer, and my teacher, Dr. Cassie Keough of NDSU, she always talks about this, of kind of having stage makeup on, where everything seems exaggerated to you, but in the audience, it just seems expressive. And I think at NYO2, I've developed a lot more confidence in projecting the character, in showing the emotion of the piece. And when I say that, it kind of sounds obvious, but in classical music, showing the emotion of the piece is so difficult. You know, it's so nuanced. It's more, you have to think it, of course, yourself. But then there's so many different little techniques to really project that kind of story onto the audience and make them feel not just that you can play these notes in, you know, perfect rhythm, but that they actually feel something when they listen to it.
How many hours a day do you spend with music?
So this summer, I practiced the most I've ever practiced, about like 4 hours a day. But then usually during the school year, and depending on what competitions I'm preparing for, it'll be between 1 to 3 hours, really, if I have the time. Some days I just don't have time to practice.
And when Joanna Lynn just wants to, you know, have fun, what does she do?
Yeah, well,
besides play music.
I love just hanging out with my friends, driving around, trying out different restaurants that have opened, watching Netflix, of course.
And making up puns, I hear.
Yes, yes. I do make some bad puns. Yes.
Well, have you got one you could share?
Nope. Well, if I was making a pun in an open field, would that be a little too corny?
Okie dokie. Joanna Lynn is a Davies High School senior. She plays clarinet extremely well and will be very interested in what happens in your future life. Thanks for being with us today.
Yes, thank you so much.
More Main Street in a moment.
The young violinist on this week's From the Top is outstanding, but her first instrument was piano, and let's just say she was not a natural.
My grandparents are some of the most supportive people I know. Even they were like, you know, she's got to quit piano. She can't keep doing this.
Wow. Tough love led her to her true calling, the violin. Enjoy her performance on From the Top.
Sunday at 9 a.m. Central, here on Prairie Public.
You're listening to Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton. A lot of agriculture in our part of the country depends on rivers to cheaply move grain and other farm products to market. But this year, high water has already stranded barges on the Upper Mississippi River for nearly 3 months, the longest time in recorded history. Earlier today, Madeline Beck reported for Morning Edition on the fallout from the record high river levels.
River barges are enormous. One standard barge holds as much as 58 large semi-trucks, and in early June, about 640 barges floated to a standstill near American Commercial Barge Line's office outside Cairo, Illinois.
That's just me. That's not the other fleets in here. That's just ACBL.
That's Mark Glab, the facility manager there. His boats push these barges full of salt, grain, fertilizer, and steel up and down the river.
I get 3 or 4 calls a day, people wanting to be able to unload their barges here into trucks or into trains because we can't go on the river until the water goes down. I got plants in Chicago running out of product.
The problem isn't the barges. It's the locks and dams. Locks are the mechanisms that raise or lower a boat to get it through a dam. When river levels are too high, they're not safe to operate, so barges can't get where they need to go. And there's another problem. Barges can't unload in some places where they're stuck. Places like Cairo, Illinois, which doesn't have a port, so goods can't be offloaded onto trains or trucks. This could be a growing problem as water levels trend upwards and barges are kept waiting longer.
The only difference this year is the length of time, but it seems to get worse every year.
Glab says that 75% of recorded river crests at Cairo have happened since the 80s. So high waters could conceivably encourage city planners to try and build more ports to get stranded products off the river. And that could give rural places like Cairo a boost, a town with about 2,000 people, no grocery stores, and no gas stations. Larry Klein heads the Port Authority there and is a fourth-generation Cairo resident.
I've seen it in its heyday, and I see it today. And, well, it hurts. I want to stay around and say that I knew the people that helped get us back on the right track.
While barges and supplies were trapped going upriver, thousands of tons of grain like corn and soybeans were waiting to head downriver to be shipped overseas. And while trucking and rail were an option for some, that's too expensive for most farmers. All they could do was wait. Greg Gunther farms near St. Louis, and he says the river closure costs him in ways that are hard to calculate. Like many others, he still has grain to ship from last year. If grain is stored for too long, its quality drops along with its value. When the Mississippi was flooding, river terminals stopped buying his corn to send downriver.
And then that corn sitting in the bin is money that's waiting to be utilized that is drawing no interest, and it's costing you in electricity and everything else to keep it in condition.
Add to those issues low commodity prices, trade challenges, and extremely heavy rains affecting thousands of farmers across the Midwest. Gunther hopes this barge issue increases awareness of needed water infrastructure upgrades long overdue.
If we had a more efficient river transportation system, when these events happened, when we finally were able to get going again, it would really make things a lot smoother and cost everybody a lot less money.
While the Mississippi River system does have problems, it also makes U.S. agriculture globally competitive. It's cheaper to ship on water than on land. But that water may become an even harder force to tame as massive rainstorms cause it to peak and flood more often. For NPR News, I'm Madeline Beck in Galesburg, Illinois.
Coming up on Main Street, Prairie Public News Director Dave Thompson joins us to talk about this week's big stories, and Matt Olean reviews the new movie, The Farewell. First, the news.
For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster. The Northern Plains Unmanned Aerial Systems test site has been granted a waiver from the Federal Aviation Administration to operate UAS systems beyond visual line of sight in an urban area. This will allow Xcel Energy to use drones to inspect power lines in a city without having to use chase planes. It's part of the state's integration pilot program that will allow drones in the national airspace. North Dakota's Department of Transportation heads up the IPP program, and Russ Bullcoltz is DOT's Strategy and Innovations Director.
If you're flying beyond visual line of sight, you don't want a visual observer. We want to be able to do it by electronic means, either by radar or somehow other means. So that's our intent. And then the operations over people waivers. So if you're flying commercially, you're not allowed to fly over a massive amount of people without having that type of waiver. So these are all combined, so it allows us to fly in an urban environment.
Buchholz says DOT is also looking at ways it can use drone technology.
We're looking at emergency situations, like they had a road washout. That's a good example, you know, on the tribal lands here just recently over, and I believe it was in Morton County area. We're looking at even doing bridge inspections. There could be people involved or standing around where we need to, I'll say, inspect a bridge and where we don't have to do lane closures. So we're not putting the people at risk, and then also we're not putting our employees at risk. It's a safety issue. And also it can be done in a lot timely fashion.
The 2019 legislature authorized DOT to buy unmanned aircraft. Buchholz says the drones were delivered to DOT this week. A program to help Minnesota homeowners turn lawns into pollinator habitat will kick off this fall. A series of workshops will be held across the state. The Board of Water and Soil Resources will also take applications this winter from homeowners who want some help paying for habitat projects. Senior ecologist Dan Shaw says the program is generating a lot of interest across Minnesota and beyond.
We've had people across the country contacting us, wondering, you know, how this program started, how we're running the program. Really, there's a lot of interest across the country in this type of program, but there hasn't been many funding sources available.
The Minnesota legislature approved $900,000 over 3 years. And a big mess led to a big cleanup at the CVS Pharmacy on 30th Avenue South in Moorhead. Police Sergeant Scott Christoris says officers responded to motion alarms at the store around 1:30 this morning and discovered an ocean of water flowing inside the store from a broken water main.
A steady stream coming out the front door. The fire department got the front door open to try to relieve some of the water buildup in the store, but it was like a waterfall coming out. The entire parking lot was soaked, and there was, items from the store that had washed out into the parking lot. So it's kind of a mess.
It took Public Works about 90 minutes to find the shutoff and stop the water break. Key holders at neighboring stores in the complex were also contacted to make sure those were not flooded. For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster.
Say you have a baby.
Do you see the owl?
You raise her with love.
One day I'm going to be able to tell her, you can do this. Push yourself.
The kid's going to turn out exactly as you planned, right?
Yeah. Hold on here. It would be nice if life was like that, but life isn't like that. Life is hard.
Are we bound by our DNA, or can a parent change it? That's on the next Radio Lab.
Saturday at noon, 11 Mountain, right here on Prairie Public.
It's time to talk about the week's big stories with our news director here at Prairie Public, Dave Thompson. And Dave, as the wire machine fades in the background,
yes.
The number one story that I saw on our news page at prairiepublic.org, go up there and check it out, folks, is this headline, new record for oil and gas production in North Dakota, but flaring is also up.
That's right. What happened was we're an hour 1.4 million barrels a day in production of oil. Natural gas production is also up because of that. But Lynn Helms, the Mineral Resources Director for North Dakota, said because of some planned and unplanned outages of natural gas processing facilities and natural gas pipelines, we dropped well under the goal for gas capture, which is 88%. We were less than 80%.
Wow.
He said that should improve as some of these plants come back online, and he thinks that things should be maybe back to at least 88% capture. He has said he's very optimistic it's going to happen that way.
You know, this natural gas flaring thing is something that gets a lot of attention outside of North Dakota
because
natural gas is mostly methane. Methane is a very problematic greenhouse gas, and of course
right.
We do talk about climate change and whether or not people want to agree with it or not. Global warming is something that is statistically happening, so we need to, I think, probably be sensitive to those issues.
And I think so.
I assume he is because he was expressing some concern about it.
Well, a couple of prongs on that. Number one, he is concerned about that, and so is the North Dakota Industrial Commission, which are his bosses, and the Industrial Commission made up of the governor, the attorney general, and the agriculture commissioner. Also, he said right now natural gas prices aren't that high, but eventually that will become a valuable commodity. So they're trying to find a way to use it somehow. One thing they're talking about, of course, is petrochemicals, and we'll get into that a little bit. And they're also talking about natural gas liquids being transferred down a pipeline that will actually run in eastern Montana, but will run down to Kansas.
And while you're talking about a pipeline, the Dakota Access Pipeline, I think, is at currently its capacity is somewhere shy of 600,000 barrels a day.
Right, that's right.
And they're looking at for 1.4 million barrels a day now. There is obviously some pressure to increase that capacity, and that's
certainly
been in the news as well.
Certainly is, because remember that if you're shipping oil out of the Bakken by rail or by truck, there's a premium. that you pay on that. So you're not getting what you normally would get as full value. But if you can ship it by pipeline, then you will get full value because you don't have a third party in there in transporting it.
Yeah, we still see a lot of oil trains going through Fargo-Moorhead.
There certainly are. They've ticked up a little bit, you know, because of – and it's pricing, and there's a whole complicated set about, you know, where's the best price you can get for your oil. And rail or truck is one way to ship it there.
Okay. Well, you mentioned this petrochemical issue. The 2019 legislature passed tax breaks for petrochemical firms, and you reported on that this week.
I certainly did. And what I remember the discussion, and there was a little bit of skepticism when it went through the legislature, but there's a lot more optimism that North Dakota is going to get something for petrochemicals. And reason being is that a group of legislators and Governor Burgum went to Alberta to take a look at the petrochemical industry up there. And some big names are interested in coming to North Dakota because we have that surfeit of natural gas. They're looking at that because that's where you get the anes, the methanes, the butane, the propane, the ethane, et cetera.
And all of this stuff we've been talking about has been on the plate of the Energy and Transmission Committee that Rich Wardner heads, isn't he?
Right, the Senate Majority Leader, yes, that's right. And, you know, they basically created the committee with kind of a blank slate. And he came up with about 30 topics that the committee could take a look at. But he said right up top, flaring of natural gas, followed by petrochemical, which are basically, you know, intermingled at that point. So there's going to be a lot of discussion, I think, in the interim. The committee plans to have four meetings, and they're going to be packed with a lot of discussion.
Well, here's something else that will get discussed quite a bit. The committee is beginning a study of what to do with the legacy fund earnings. This is another interim legislative committee. You reported on this earlier today.
I reported on that, and that the case is during the legislative session because it was the first time that the earnings go into the general fund. So there's a pot of money there. Okay, what are we going to do with it? Well, you know, the economy has improved after being down between 15 and 17. So there was a lot of ideas about what to do with it. One was to reinvest it all back into the legacy fund. A second one was to end income tax in North Dakota. There was also some spending discussions about infrastructure spending. Everything failed. And instead, they went to a study and said, we really need to take a more in-depth look at this. And it comes at an interesting time because you're well aware of all the problems in Alaska with their funding.
Absolutely. And they have a serious crisis.
They have
there.
A serious crisis there. And North Dakota is saying, okay, we can learn some lessons from that and not go down that road.
There's an effort actually underway right now in Alaska to recall the governor.
I've heard that. And because of all the education cuts.
Like 40 to 50% to the University
of
Alaska.
Yes.
But this legacy fund is now in excess of $6 billion, right?
Right. That's right. And the projection I heard from the money managers who work for the investment office said we could see $18 billion in 10 years. It's very possible.
Well.
So it's growing, and the state wants to be very cautious about what you'd use it for. Now, what they talked about at the committee, if I can just go on for a second, Doug, there was talk in the committee of having statutory funds set up, not a constitutional fund. Because if you wanted to give a check to every North Dakotan, you would have to change the Constitution. And given Alaska's situation, there's not a lot of appetite for that in the legislature.
Yeah. Well, let's get that fund a bit bigger, I guess,
before we
start talking about that stuff.
That's correct.
You also had a report earlier this week about an interim committee studying rural grocery stores. We've talked about this on Main Street, that there are some places where there aren't any more grocery stores.
They call them food deserts.
Yeah.
And, you know, you've talked about at one point, cities of 2,100 people or less had 137. Now they're down to 90-something. And some of the grocery stores, as we heard in committee, are municipally run or run by volunteers or really are thinking about, you know, shutting up shop. And it's a little bit nerve-wracking. And yet, at the same time, you might argue that, well, you know, big box stores are only 25, 50 miles away. But what if you have a craving for something, or what if you need something, especially fresh vegetables? That's a real concern too. What if you need them? Do you have to drive a 100-mile round trip to go get fresh vegetables? But by the time you get back, are they fresh?
Well, in lots of parts of the state, the convenience store is the grocery store.
That is correct. And now these things, I guess there's a firm called Dollar General that's moving into North Dakota.
And Minnesota.
And Minnesota. And they apparently have a grocery section too. So there's a lot of things at play here. And full disclosure, my father worked for the Super Value Warehouse in Bismarck. And before that, he got his start in the grocery business at what was then called Nash Finch in Minot, which was Spartan Nash. That warehouse closed. Well, so I'm a little familiar with some of the grocery things and what goes on.
My dad, but before he got into the newspaper business, as a kid, he used to unload bananas from railroad cars in Detroit Lakes and told me about occasionally finding a tarantula. That was the exciting story.
Wow, yes.
Let's talk about the 2020 census in North Dakota. Tom McDonald reported on that earlier this week.
They're really gearing up because it's getting close. They're going to be starting to take numbers fairly soon. And everybody wants to make sure the count is accurate because there are lots of things that are tied to it, including some federal aid if you need that, and some other things that have to do with, you know, will you have two congressional districts instead of one? Even though we're at 725,000 people, it doesn't look like we're going to get a second congressional district just yet. But if we see a real influx of people, we could see another congressional district created because remember – and maybe you don't, but back in the 60s and early 70s, we did have two congressional districts for a while.
Yeah. Now we've got we're one of those states that has the unique status of an at-large representative.
At-large, right, exactly.
You reported, or Todd McDonald reported late last week about the Devil's Lake is still at a pretty high level despite a relatively dry summer for them compared to others.
Yes, but that's been rising since the 1990s, so you can understand why. Even though I saw a drought monitor map that said that area is now in drought, a very small area, but that area is now in drought. And at the same time, you know, they've been running pumps, and let's be honest, there's been some lawsuits regarding problems with seepage from the canals that go to the Cheyenne River.
Well, I remember the first time I went to Devil's Lake was many years ago in the late 70s, and they had that big stick there that showed the historic high point of that lake.
Right.
And that stick has been underwater now for a very long time.
It sure has.
In Todd's story, he ended it by saying that Devil's Lake is still 23 feet higher than when the lake started its rise in 1993.
Exactly.
Well, there is an interesting story in Bismarck, a Ducks Unlimited city park.
It is. Now, Ducks Unlimited is close to the river, and it's down a steep city street called Burnt Boat Road. And right next to it is open space. It's owned by the Claremont family. The Claremont family has agreed it will, you know, set aside some of that land for a park. Ducks Unlimited is going to raise money for it, and they would convert it to a 125-acre park and then deed it to the city of Bismarck. And that area is a great walking area. It's got lots of trails around it, and there could be some wildlife habitat there. And Ducks Unlimited says this is a good fit.
Well, when I went up on our website and saw your story, there was a photograph of the sort of the proposed acreage.
Mm-hmm.
And what a gift that would be to the city.
Very, very good gift. And really, that's a nice-sized park at 125 acres.
All right. Well, we check in with our news director, Dave Thompson, every Friday. Have a great weekend, Dave.
I hope you do, too.
It's a hot summer weekend, so why not cool off with conversations with cool people like Anna Kendrick, Ozzie Smith, and Jerry Rice, plus the unrevealed secrets of our panelists finally revealed, and a visit with an old friend, you know, to talk about Kaz. I'm Peter Sagal. It's the news quiz that's like a fresh breeze on a humid day. So join us for Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me from NPR.
Saturday at 10 Central, 9 Mountain.
Arts programming on Prairie Public is supported in part by the North Dakota Council on the Arts, a state agency developing, promoting, and supporting the arts in North Dakota.
It's time to go to the movies with Matt O'Lean, and this week you're going to a movie that I got to see, too. It has sort of a, you know, subtle title, The Farewell, but I loved it.
Based on an actual lie. That is how the film starts. It shows you that that little teaser of what you're about to see. Saw it at the Fargo Theater. Please check your listings throughout the state. It is making its way around to cinemas that would play a subtitled movie, and it is largely subtitled, Doug. If you've seen the trailer, folks out there, you know this is based on Awkwafina, who is a rising star, stand-up comedian, hilarious, Crazy Rich Asians. She's mostly been known for comedy, but she plays a young New Yorker born in China, but her parents emigrated there when she was six, so she's essentially Americanized, as people would say. Her grandmother is sick. Has cancer.
Nai Nai,
they call her. Played expertly by Xuzhan Zhao, who I am calling it right now, Doug, will receive an Oscar nomination. That's my first call of the year.
I would second it.
I don't know if she'll be in the supporting or the lead. I suspect it'll be supporting, and they will push Awkwafina for the lead actress nomination. So basically, their family goes to China. They all know she's sick, but they're going there for a wedding for Awkwafina's cousin, who's getting married to a Japanese woman. And so you have a lot of culture clash going on. But the trick of the movie that you see in the trailer is Nai Nai doesn't know she's sick. She thinks she's fine. And they're keeping it from her. And apparently this is a part of Chinese custom. Why worry her? It's going to happen anyway. We all know she does not need to know that she's dying of cancer. So Awkwafina, her character, you know, having been raised in America, thinks this is stupid.
Well, it'd be against the law in America.
It'd be illegal.
Yeah.
Which her father points out in the scene. So she is torn, you know, and should I tell her? Should I not tell her? So this kind of thing hangs over the film as we go there to China. What I loved about the film, Doug, and this is probably in my top three so far of the year, right up there with Once Upon a Time in Hollywood and Avengers Endgame and Midsommar and some of those, it never spills into maudlin sentimentality. Look, this is a film. You've got the dying film, the cancer film. We've all seen this kind of film. And in the wrong hands, it can be icky. It can come off like a Lifetime movie, like a movie of the week. And the music will swell and we're all supposed to feel sad. That never happens. It is very much, there's funny parts to it. Nai Nai is hilarious. Awkwafina, not funny in this. She's very dour. We barely get a smile out of her in this film.
She has a crying scene.
But she's excellent. She proves that she can do serious drama, but the film never tips into sentimentality. It's really about differing cultures. Awkwafina says, we would tell her in America. Well, we're here in China, we're part of the collective whole. We're not going to tell her. So you have her family that has moved away from China interacting with cousins, uncles, who have not left China, and you sometimes feel like you're looking at two different families because of what living in America is like compared to living in China. I love that aspect of it. I love the lack of sentimentality of it. I love the stars. I mean, this is based on Lulu Wang, the director's childhood, very autobiographical. It comes off that way. You know, she was born in China, went to the U.S. when she was six. Now she's an accomplished director. And the film, even though it's subtitled mostly, you know, when Awkwafina speaks to her parents, they speak English. So again, be prepared. You're probably looking at 75% subtitled in the film. The rest is not subtitled. But I loved it. It's a very good film. I think it has Oscar chops. Definitely the kind of film that could get some Oscar nominations for the actors and the screenplay and the director. We'll have to see what the rest of the year holds when we do our fall movie preview in September. But this is a film that could have easily went off the rails into bad sentimentality, and it does not do it.
Well, the thing that amazed me, first of all, it was a small audience when I went to it at the Fargo Theater, but everybody left that place grinning. It was such a neat movie.
Yes.
And a lot of it takes place around a dinner table.
It does.
And food is a sort of a
huge
main character as well.
Yes.
But the individual family members are so well drawn as unique characters that you can't help but love this family.
So what Wang does here, Doug, we talked about this last week with Last Black Man in San Francisco, where I felt some characters were underwritten. That doesn't happen here. It's very difficult to direct a film with about 12 or 13 people around a dinner table. It felt like a Woody Allen movie at points, you know, like what Woody Allen would direct a film with this big family like Han and her sisters, except we're in China. It had a little bit of that to it. I'd love to ask Lulu Wang if she was influenced by Allen's films. I don't know that for sure. But yes, the characters are well written. even the Japanese bride who barely speaks, cannot speak Chinese, she's an interesting character.
And her Chinese groom is.
Yes.
They're just
so
unique.
So she does such a, and this may be because this happened to her, it's her life on screen, that the characters are well written. Even the supporting characters come off as full characters, like Awkwafina's parents, who are both very good in the picture as well. They fight that tug of being born in China, but now living in New York City. So she pulls it off. It's a wonderful film. It's a subtle film. It doesn't bang you over the head with, you need to feel this way because Nai Nai's sick, or you need to feel this way because we're all happy. There's very little background music in the film, which is something typically non-American directors do. Foreign films don't use a lot of background music to heighten emotion. So I liked it a lot.
But the music they did use was so evocative that, like I told you, I sat through the credits to hear the end of it.
Yes.
It was that good to me.
Yeah.
And I just loved the way the story was told and the fact that, given the tensions that are in the world these days, I mean, the environment we're currently in, seeing China this way I think is useful.
Yeah, we don't see a lot of Chinese locations. I mean, we're basically at Nai Nai's house and in the hotel room.
But we're seeing Chinese behavior.
Behavior, and living in a communist country.
It builds up to a wedding party that is uniquely Chinese and yet reminds me of a fair number of American ones too.
Now, there are some interesting twists in the third act. We're not going to reveal those. People need to go to this film, but I would urge people to see this. I think it's a film that people who do not have ancestors from Asia would still like the film. It doesn't have to be it's a film. What I like about movies like this, Doug, it crosses genres.
Yes.
It crosses cultures. That's what it does. Awkwafina also, you know, her mother was Korean, her father Chinese. So she is definitely part of this whole Asian-American success story. And I think Awkwafina has the chops to be a real movie star, Doug. I really kind of feel it. A lot of parts are going to come her way. She's very engaging. She's funny. But she shows here she can play pathos as well.
Well, director-writer Lulu Wang, kudos to her.
Mm-hmm.
So that is my Oscar trivia question basis this time. Who was the first Asian to win the Academy Award for Best Director?
Ang Lee in 2005 for Brokeback Mountain.
And he won again in?
For Life of Pi in 2012.
We've been to the movies with Matt Ho Lee.
This week on Away With Words, how reggae got its name.
I was wondering about the term reggae. I've heard somewhere that Toot Tibbert helped popularize the term reggae through his song Do the Reggae. I wasn't sure if they actually coined the term or just popularized it.
Join us this week on Away With Words.
Saturday at 9 Central, 8 Mountain, here on Prairie Public.
How do we define and live with risk in unexpected places?
You see a lot more populism when we live in uncertain times, and we are living in uncertain times now.
I'm John Donvan. That's my guest, Allison Schrager, author of An Economist Walks Into a Brothel.
Usually, if you visit a sex worker, there's a lot of risk involved.
Disrupting the way we talk about risk on the next Intelligence Squared U.S.
Intelligence Squared U.S., this week's Prairie Public Presents, coming up Sunday afternoon at 5 Central, 4 Mountain.
This is Dakota Datebook for August 16th. On this date in 1902, in Higginsville, Missouri, John Clark Salyer II, the father of the National Wildlife Refuge System, was born. To those who knew him growing up, this title makes sense. As a teenager, he got permission to leave school early and run his trap line in the marshes. He would catch foxes, raccoons, skunks, and opossums, which earned him up to $750 a year. He used that money to pay for his college degree. Salyer became a school teacher in Kansas and then a professor of biology. In 1933, he accepted a position with the Iowa Fish and Game Commission. In June the following year, J. Ding Darling, who was in charge of the Bureau of Biological Survey, asked Salyer to head the Wildlife Refuge Program. But Salyer was hesitant. However, he took leave to develop a waterfall management program which focused on habitat preservation. That experience led Salyer to accept a permanent position with the Bureau in December. He was afraid to fly, so the Bureau provided him with a car.
In 6 weeks, he covered 18,000 miles and made plans for 600,000 acres of refuge lands. Salyer would often drive hundreds of miles to visit refuge managers and stay the night or simply have a meal before taking off to another refuge. His hard work paid off. When he took the job in 1934, the refuge system was 1.5 million acres. When he retired in 1961, refuge lands covered nearly 29 million acres. Salyer was remarkably sharp and remained active after retirement as an advisor, recalling specific details about refuges even after going blind. He kept it up until his death on his birthday in 1966. That same year, the Fish and Wildlife Service named the Lower Souris Valley Wildlife Refuge in North Dakota to honor him. The J. Clark Salyer National Wildlife Refuge is the largest refuge in North Dakota, spanning 58,700 acres. Over 270 species of birds have been seen there, with 160 species nesting in the refuge. It is one of only 10 refuges featured in the Smithsonian Centennial Exhibit in 2003-2004. And the North Dakota Natural Heritage Inventory lists it as one of two intact ecological landscapes in North Dakota. So if you ever find yourself on the refuge, remember that its name honors the very man who made it possible. Today's Dakota Datebook was written by Lucid Thomas. I'm Errol Pepcorn.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding from Humanities North Dakota.
Saturday, the latest on protests in Hong Kong. Strangers rally to mark a passing in El Paso. And what do white teenage boys find as they scroll through Instagram?
It's a scary world out there when it starts to become Nazi and anti-woman type of content.
One mother on what to look for and what to do. That and more. Saturday on Weekend Edition from NPR News.
7 a.m. Central, right here on Prairie Public.
Next Saturday, we'll host the launch of the Dakota Datebook book aboard the Lewis and Clark Riverboat on the Missouri River at Bismarck. And that got us thinking that it might be interesting to learn more about that boat, its story, and what you can see when you're aboard. We'll talk with Aaron Barth on our show Monday. He's the executive director of the Fort Abraham Lincoln Foundation, which operates the riverboat. We'll also have a Plains Folk essay from Tom Ezern. Horticulturist Ron Smith will answer lawn and garden questions, and we'll have another presentation from July's TEDx Fargo event. And then Sunday morning at 10 Central on Main Street Weekend, we'll feature elements of shows this week. We'll have Zahra Hankier, a Lebanese-British journalist who edited a book titled Are Women on the Ground? Essays by Arab Women Reporting from the Arab World. Marianne Phillips of Fargo will recount her retirement adventure. This summer, she traveled to Tanzania to climb the tallest mountain on the African continent, Mount Kilimanjaro. And we'll have a segment of Main Street Eats featuring Sue Balcom. We hope you can join us for Main Street Weekend, 10 Central on Sunday, and Main Street, 3 o'clock Central, Monday through Friday. Have a great weekend.